people can look at me and go, well, if Amanda can do it, I can do it.
The journey ahead is adventurous. It's fun, but it's also going to require a lot of work and perseverance and tenacity on your end.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended.
I have to do what I was put on this planet to do, and that is fly around the world.
Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 96 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. This episode is the second in our feature on women in aviation. We have a brief news segment, of which I'm going to be joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. And we then have two interviews. The first is with Captain Brenda Romero, the second with Amanda Harrison. We hope you enjoy these interviews and we hope you enjoy the stories they have to tell. Tim, thanks for joining me. Tim is, of course, the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine at the Royal Aeronautical Society. Tim, how are you today?
I'm very well indeed. It's good to be back.
Yes, good to be back. We're just going to do a quick run round of the news. Also, find out a bit about what you've been up to over the past month or so. Gareth is off today, and we've got a couple of interviews lined up for this episode, Women in Aerospace, which is our second episode in this feature, proving to be very popular. But should we have a look at a few things that have caught our eye in the news?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty busy.
Yeah, it has. Okay, first story up then, Tim, is you spent some time at the DSEI exhibition, and the news I picked up is that Italy now is joining the Tempest team.
Yeah, that's right. So that was the big news at this year's DSEI, which is the bigger defence exhibition in the Docklands that comes around every 2 years. So if you were sort of watching news for the military aviation from the air sector, that was the big news that Italy had signed up to cooperate on Team Tempest, which is the UK's next generation fighter technology program. It was launched last year to great fanfare. In July, we had Sweden that has also signed up again to cooperate and to partner on it and to be a part of it and to explore ways in which these two countries now cooperate with the UK and on bringing a next generation fighter into service. So basically, what comes after Gripen and what comes after Eurofighter Typhoon. Italy in particular has got good synergies with the UK because they've operated Tornado, they operate obviously Eurofighter, and they will have a Eurofighter F-35 mix and even some F-35Bs, so exactly the same frontline fighter mix as the UK. And they're also involved through Leonardo, the UK bit of Leonardo, which does the sort of radars, sensors, electronic warfare, self-defense systems. So they're already kind of plugged in already in a way with that.
Yeah, Yeah. And Tim, when Tempest was announced last year, to be fair, in big fanfare, but it didn't seem to have much legs then. It's really looking like a serious project now. Did I hear that Lockheed had an interest in potentially being involved in some way?
Oh no! Yeah, that, you're up on me on that. No, but I think you're right to say that there is now momentum going on, getting into it. I mean, these sort of international partners have come on board. That's a big boost for the project. It shows it's credible, and it gives an alternative. So over the channel, the other sort of alternative is the FCAS, Future Combat Air System. That's France and Germany are working together. That was announced at the Paris Air Show. That's a little bit more difficult, in there are sort of a little bit more sort of, I think, differing requirements between, you know, what France might want, you know, nuclear capable, if it's going to replace Rafale, and they might want it to fly for an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
So exploring that, and also who does what, you know, the big question over work share, and how do you kind of manage that. You know, you think of France, you've got Thales, Dassault, Snecma as the big, you know, so avionics, airframes, engines. You know, perhaps for the Germans there's a key question, well, what do we get to do? So that's going to be it's still early days. There's a lot to sort of shake out, and a lot of jockeying for position. You know, some people predict that these things will actually come together and they'll merge and become one program, European program. Others that, you know, you might might stay separate, end up with two, but you might get more partners. You know, there might be other countries there that are, you know, interested in joining, say Tempest, you know, say Japan, for instance. But it's interesting, and it's got you know, it's got legs now, it's got momentum, and there's some really interesting stuff going on about how they want to break the Norman Augustine's law of ever increasing cost of fighters. So how do you get this down and really sort of kind of focus on the software? So the airframe is almost, I would say, irrelevant, because that's the wrong word for it, but it's the software, the upgradability, the flexibility. You know, what weapons can you put in there, what drone fighter, what drone wingmans might be able to control, and really making, I wouldn't say the airframe is disposable in a way, but the core of it is making the sort of the software, the really kind of clever bit, and the bit that you can easily update and you can easily change, and then you just put it onto a new bit of hardware. A bit like how smartphones work. You know, you've got your Android operating system, you've got your iPhone, you know, you've got your Apple operating system, and you know, OS, you put it on your smartphone. What phone it is just a sort of a matter of preference, really.
Yeah. And Tim, I saw the news coming out of the exhibition last week. There seemed to be a lot of talk about drone products, particularly anti and strike drone products, obviously particularly in the military area, but they could be used for civilian as well. And I thought it was quite interesting, the difference between the military use of anti-drone technology, which is more strike them out, versus the civilian design products, which are more about safety and bringing the drone down. Did you see anything there was of particular interest?
Well, I mean, that was a big focus at DSE as well. Counter drone technology is now a big business. It's a big concern. How do you stop small drones? And previous, if we think back almost a year ago, we had the great Gatwick, battle of Gatwick drones that closed a major airport down. And you know, people have always looked at this. It's not just Gatwick; other airports have been affected. And people have been looking at this and worrying and thinking, oh, hang on, you know, you've had drone assassinations in Yemen. And that sort of counter drone technology is now hot property. But you're right in that there is a split there between the security, well, the military kind of response, where you can layer sort of missiles. You know, you could theoretically take down a DJI drone with a Patriot if you wanted to, but it'd be a bit of overkill and a bit expensive. Which is why now people are doing counter drones, where you send a small cheap drone to intercept another drone. And you sort of stand off. There's microwave stuff. There's close-in missiles. And at the end of the day, there's the, you know, sort of chain guns and Avenger cannons and stuff like that. In the civil realm, you don't really want to be putting a kind of like a Sky Guard, you know, a close-in defense weapon system, you know, on the end of the approach at Heathrow and, you know, inadvertently bringing down passenger jets when you're firing it. I don't know, you know, sort of, you know, Billy's drone is flying for the first time. And putting metal in the air. So you've got to think of other ways to get it down, you know, sort of, you know, the hacking them, hijacking them, sending them to back to their sender, following them or bringing them down. And in actual fact, the military, one of the guys I was talking to there, who was a military, UK military serving personnel, who was explaining, was saying that you know, a lot of the time you think, oh well, there's a drone there with a bomb on it or a 40mm grenade or something like that, and you think, oh, wouldn't it be a good idea to destroy it? Actually, what you want to do is you want to bring it down safely, send someone over, defuse it, and then use it for forensics, because that way you get the intelligence as who's made this, where is it being used. So there is. It's not quite as clear cut as, well, the military could just go, you know, kind of weapons free, and the you know, civil thing is just you know, capture. There are good reasons as well why the military would want to, you know, sort of land a drone safely and take a look at it and take a look at who's built it.
Yeah, interesting. So yeah, I was in London actually last week, saw lots of people in uniforms, and it took me an hour or two to work out they were all at that event. It did look like an interesting event. You got to meet a few people. We got to meet Tim Davies on the Astralis
Aerolis stand. Absolutely did. Yeah. They were right next to the big Tempest mock-up. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, looking forward to getting Tim on the show and talking to him. Let's move on then, Tim. Boeing has been suffering, as we all know, over the 737 Max, but the tanker saga, the KC-46, continues. Now they've got problems carrying passengers and cargo as well. Apparently an incident where a cargo shifted in flight, and the Air Force has basically put Boeing on warning, and at the moment it's struggling to deliver fuel, cargo or passengers. They're really having a rough time of it at the moment, aren't they?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that. You know, I don't know who cursed it.
I mean, they had the issue with FOD a few months ago, loose debris in the aircraft. I mean, it's just that shot.
You know, it's been on a series of ongoing problems with this, and you know, the latest, obviously, as you say, the latest thing is the cargo lock. You know, the cargo lock coming loose in flight, something that is obviously very, very dangerous if you've got heavyweight pallets of cargo moving. There was a terrible video, I think, from Bagram in Afghanistan, which showed 747 as to what can happen if the cargo shifts and you know, makes you tail heavy. So again, you know, it's something else that's on top of the KC-46. I mean, I'm sure that one is a probably a really simple fix to work out what the problem is. But the US Air Force obviously taking no chances, had to ground them. It's yet another sort of black mark for the KC-46.
Boeing can't get anything right at the moment. Let's leave the military news there then and come to civil news. As we record today on the 24th, yesterday or early this morning, we lost a icon from the sky, Thomas Cook, and the process has kicked in for the passengers that are abroad to be repatriated. We're seeing some fascinating aircraft being deployed. I just saw some pictures just before we came on of a Malaysian A380 going from Mallorca back to the UK. So it's quite an exercise, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the one good thing you can say about this, I suppose, is the repatriation plan. Operation Matterhorn from the CAA seems to have been well planned, organised well, and put in place beforehand, rather than. There was enough warning about it that they were in trouble. So there's enough time to sort of charter aircraft, about 45 jets to bring 150,000 holidaymakers home. Really sort of sad day there. 178 years old, 9,000 jobs in the UK, at risk after this. It's a historic name, isn't it, in sort of high street holidays, travel agents, but I think they just, kind of, as well as poor management and large debts, I think they just didn't keep up with the times. Is that we all now rely, but majority of us now are so used to booking things online on cheap deals, going directly to Ryanair's site, and even though we might kind of grit our teeth when we do it, and unbundling products and arranging our own holidays. It's just one of the things that they've not kept up with the business model, and they're not the only one. There's other airlines in trouble as well. Monarch, we've already seen Monarch go, another historic name. This week we'd ordered, there was XL Airways is in trouble from France. I think it's Adriana Airways, I think.
All right,
Slovenian carrier.
Is it? Okay.
So,
yeah.
So,
yeah, it's challenging times. Just looking at the fallout of this for the aviation sector, particularly in the UK, but across Europe as well. Lots of pilots, lots of air crew, flight crew lost their jobs overnight. I've seen an awful lot of activity on social media to possibly redirect them into other opportunities. Whilst there's not going to be enough gaps in the UK, potentially in the future, but not at the moment, there is a shortage of air crew. Is there any synergy in this whole disaster that potentially sees some of these people being repatriated to the growth areas around the world?
I could be. I mean, if you're willing to move, yeah, and you've got you've done your training, and yes, it has cost. It's cost a lot of money to get you into that position, but you are an asset in demand in places around the world where they are dying, crying out for pilots, and these things tend to go in a sort of. Kind of boom and bust. And I think I saw a comment on Twitter the other day which said something like, one of my elders always told me, you're not a true airline pilot unless you've been laid off at least once.
It's historically been more frequent in stateside, and they really see boom to bust model, don't they? But I suppose seeing Monarch and now Thomas Cook go on this side of the pond, it's really brought home how fragile the difference between success and failure is. I mean, you look at their fleet, they've got quite a modern fleet. I know a lot of the aircraft were leased, but, you know, a very modern fleet, you know, strong branding, and just don't understand why it's all gone wrong. But we do hope and we wish all the very best to all the staff who lost their jobs overnight, and hopefully find employment again soon.
Definitely, yeah.
And just finally then, Tim, to wrap up in the news, we've seen the attacks on the Saudi oil refineries in the last few weeks. The Americans have stepped up their presence there, but the Saudis got a fair old mix of hardware themselves, particularly aircraft on hand. What do you think we might be able to see from them in what is almost an inevitable standoff that's starting to kick in?
Well, I mean, yeah, we've been talking about counter drone technology earlier, and this attack on the, you know, sort of you know, Saudi Arabian oil facility, you know, put a dent in the world oil production. Unbelievable. Combination of drones and cruise missiles getting past the, you know, one of the most highly defended targets in the world to cause massive economic damage. So it's a bit like you know, you think of Matthias Rust, who flew his Cessna you know, all the way from you know, West Germany to Moscow and landed in Red Square. It's that kind of wake up call for Saudi Arabia, and not just Saudi Arabia, but everybody else, is that you know, these technologies such as low cost, you know, kind of suicide drones and cruise missiles, you know, low cost cruise missiles, you know, the Houthis from Yemen, Yemen rebels, they didn't make them themselves, you know, these sort of cruise missiles. So these kind of groups have got cruise missile technology, and you know, they can go on Google Maps and they can plan. You know, you look at the latest sort of commercially available satellite imagery. You can plan your routes around where you think the SAM sites might be and get in. You know, so there's a big question there as to what happened to their air defences. So what's going to happen next? Well, obviously, the big question. However, I think weirdly the response has been fairly muted. You know, if your next door neighbour just committed an act of war and set all your oil on fire, it's been fairly kind of low key. And I think that reading between the lines, they seem to be waiting for US support or help, or even the US sort of striking on their behalf. You know, and also, despite the devastation, spike in oil prices, you know, I haven't seen any word of lives being lost in the attack. I could be wrong there, but you know, if lives haven't been lost, then is that a sub-threshold economic attack? You know, how would you justify killing people in return? You know,
Tim, what have the Saudis got in their strike arsenal then, in terms of aircraft?
In terms of strike arsenal, they've got the obviously tornadoes, they've got the sort of typhoons, and they've got they're getting hold of the latest version of the F-15 Strike Eagle, which is now called the F-15 SA, which has got the most advanced model of the Eagle. It's got a new electronic warfare system. It's got fly-by-wire. It unlocks two extra wing stations there. It's an absolute beast, you know, and it's got the latest sort of avionics and radar on it. That is one fearsome aircraft.
So, Tim, why, from a strategic point of view then, are they waiting for the Americans with the kit that they've got? I suppose the point I'm hinting at is they've got a very powerful arsenal themselves.
Well, you know, I mean, one obviously, if you were going to be cynical, if one wants to be cynical and one wants to say, a spike in oil prices, is that necessarily a bad thing? And no one's that's obviously a very cynical sort of reading as to no lives have been lost. Or it could be a matter of what do we target in return? You know, if the launches have moved, if it's if you're talking about these drones, what are you actually hitting in return? Is there a factory there? Is it? I think it is sort of surprising. I think I can't help thinking that if this been happened in Ronald Reagan's time, F-111s would now be over Tehran, bombing something. But it's a real wake up call for defending against drones, cheap cruise missiles, as to, you can have things like Sky Guard, you can have things like Croatal, SAM systems, you can have things like Patriot. But if they're looking in the wrong direction, or if they're not turned on, or if your operators have got poor training, or if it's just a swarm coming your way, there's only a certain number of targets, and you've got sort of small. It's really a question for the sort of small cheap UAVs of getting in close enough, launching them from a suitable location, and just some of them will get through. So how do you deal with those sort of targets, that sort of threat?
We shall see.
We shall see. Yeah, watch this space. Yeah.
Tim, as always, thank you so much for joining us for this news update. Where can we find you online?
Okay, well, I'm usually on Twitter at RASTimR, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
Tim, catch up with you soon. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
After the break, we'll catch up with Captain Brenda Romero.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Brenda, welcome to Extended.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here chatting with you about aviation.
Well, tell me where it all started then, Brenda. You're calling me from Oklahoma today?
Yes, I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
right,
in the south central part of the U.S. And actually, my love for aviation started at a fairly young age. I decided that I wanted to learn how to fly when I was 13 years old. And ever since then, it became an obsession. Everything I did from that point forward was with the goal of learning to fly. I did a cadet training, junior cadet training for the Marines, because at that time I wanted a career in the military.
Yeah.
That didn't happen, but that's how it all started. I think it was the fascination of such a large aircraft and something that I believed to be so powerful and magical at the same time.
Now, 13's an interesting age to, I suppose, have that flicker of excitement and passion about something like aviation. What was it? Did you go on a flight somewhere, or did you see something? Where did it? What was that trigger?
Well, actually, the first time I ever set foot in an airplane, I was 8 years old when I was traveling from South America, where I was born. My family and I were relocating to the U.S. When I was 8 years old. And that was the first time I set foot in an airplane. And like I said, I thought that it was so powerful, something that can just transport you from one continent to the other. And we were traveling from Ecuador to New York, and I remember one of the first impressions I had were the lights of New York City at night. That was the first thing. And as time went by, every time I saw an airplane, what I thought was just all the freedom and power that affords you.
I digress a little bit, Brenda, but many, many years ago, probably before you were born, I would imagine, when I used to see aeroplanes coming into London, aircraft from Ecuador were quite rare. But what I do remember, the airline I think was called Equatoriana or something like that. The colour schemes were fabulous, the most amazing colour schemes. I don't suppose you remember what you flew on back then, do you?
Awesome. I think back then it was a combination of a LAN aircraft and possibly United.
Okay, good old United.
Yes. And it's quite interesting because I now work for an airline that flies on behalf of United. So.
Right. Well, I'm gonna come to that in a minute because you've achieved some of those aims you'd set yourself. But from that 13-year-old, you talked about possibly going through the military. How did you and when did you decide to learn to fly, and how did you go about it?
Okay, so as I mentioned before, I decided it when I was 13, and back then the focus was in a career in the military.
Yeah.
So at 15 years old, I did a cadet military for the Marines, and I realized that the expectation then was for me to be 21 years old for them to consider training me. And that was something that my mom opposed to, as I graduated barely 17 years old when I graduated from high school. And she believed those following 4 years to be prime years to just wait on a maybe. And that is the reason why I decided to go the civilian route. So I enrolled at 17 years old. I enrolled in a 141 school. It's called Spartan College of Aeronautics, located here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Brenda, just for those who don't know what a 141 school is, what does that mean?
Okay, well, a 141 flight school, it's basically an aviation college. It's a college that's designed to train you specifically for aviation. So when you graduate from there, you graduate with all your flight certificates. And on top of that, this particular school also offered a college degree.
Right, okay. What's that, is that normally an expensive process to go through?
Yes. You know, I believe probably everywhere in the world, aviation flight training is quite expensive. But I was fortunate enough to have parents, specifically have a mother that believed in my dreams. At first, when I told her about my intentions, about my goal of becoming a pilot, she was a little concerned because she didn't know anything about the career and wasn't sure if she could help me in an area that she had no idea about. But I was such a rebel, and I said, I want nothing else. Nothing else would do. So she eventually bent her arm and just supported me in my dream.
And how did that go through that flight school? What were the sorts of challenges you faced?
Well, you know, one of the first things was the fact that I actually grew up in New Jersey in the East Coast part of the country. And the first thing was for me to pack all my things at barely 17 years old and move to the South Central part of the country to attend flight school. I was fortunate in the fact that I was raised to be extremely independent. And by that time, I knew how to survive on my own. But that was the first thing, to just pack my belongings and, and start fresh somewhere new and alone. As far as the flight training, the first thing that happened when I walked into the class was the fact that I believe it was 11 of us, and I was the only girl, and I was the youngest one. On top of that, everybody, wow. I was barely 17 years old, so yeah. Everybody else was at least, I think the youngest ones were at least 3 years older than me, and the rest were somewhere in their late 20s, early 30s. And actually, the average age for a flight student is about 32 years old, which I didn't know at that time. So everybody else, all my classmates had some type of life or work experience. Some of them already had a college degree under their belt. So that was the first realization, I guess, to realize that I was fairly young and in a room with people that had a college degree, that had life experience, work experience, and a lot of them already had some type of previous flight experience as well.
Okay, so you were literally starting from 0 hours.
Yes. So one of the things that a lot of people do is go through what's called a discovery flight to see if flight training is really something that they want to pursue. And in my case, the first time I was in an airplane, I was 8 years old. And the second time I got on an airplane was to go to flight training.
Right. Okay. Wow. And as a young 17-year-old, you mentioned not only being the youngest, but being the only woman. How did you feel about that?
You know, I guess I was a little ignorant in the whole topic of aviation being a male-dominated field. I never really thought about that.
Yeah. in some ways, probably served you well.
Yes, it really did. I never considered it when I wanted to learn how to fly. That wasn't something that I thought about or that I considered. The realization came when I actually set foot in the school and realized that I was the only girl. And I remember one of the instructors said, "You know, Brenda, we usually have at least two or three girls per class, but this time you're the only one. But you seem pretty comfortable. I think you're going to be okay." So, that gave me a little bit of encouragement.
Yeah. And were you okay? How did it go?
As far as the flight training there, it went okay. At first, as I said, I was fairly new to aviation. I literally knew nothing about airplanes other than the fact that it had wings. So everything I learned about aviation, it was a pretty steep learning curve. The first class, I remember, I struggled a lot with. And by the third class, I was at the top of the class.
And Brenda, you said you hinted at struggling in some of the early classes. Why was that, and how did you overcome it?
I think the first portion of it was that I didn't struggle with anything before as far as academics, and aviation is such a technical field in many regards. So learning all these new technical terms and everything that comes with it was a struggle for me. But I stuck with it. I remember the first class, I had a high C, which I wasn't comfortable with, but things started improving. And by the third class, which was regulations, I was at the top of the class. So it served me well to just continue persevering.
Okay. Well done. So what happened when you graduated from flight school?
When I graduated from flight school, I actually got hired as a flight instructor by that same school.
Okay. Is that usual? Is that a usual process?
Well, you know, this was probably in the year 2011, 2012. I was fairly young. I believe I was 20, 21 years old.
Yeah.
And back then, actually, aviation was extremely competitive. To obtain my first job at the school that I graduated from was actually quite a process. It included a written test with the hardest questions you can think of, and a simulator session, and on top of that, a panel interview with the chief pilot, the assistant chief, and the top eight instructors that can ask you any question ranging from aviation to flight training to personal questions. So it's all eyes on you for 1 hour with 10 people in a room. So it was quite competitive. In fact, when I graduated, it took probably close to 6 months for me to get hired on.
And Brenda, being such a youngster and a qualified flight instructor, how difficult was it at that age to be instructing older people with, as you use the term, a lot more life experience and things like that? How did you do?
It was a learning curve for me. I think one of the biggest things as a flight instructor is to be able to switch that mentality of going from student to being technically the boss in the airplane as a flight instructor. So in my case, as you mentioned, I was a fairly young instructor, and I was teaching students that were much older than me with a lot more life experience. So at first it was an adjustment until I proved myself, quote unquote, that I had the ability to instruct and that I can make them progress in their flight training. But at first it was an adjustment. I did have one student that I believe wasn't willing to take flight training from me just because he believed I was so young.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember my early flight training, and some of my instructors were quite young. I don't think they were ever that young. Age didn't seem to be a problem to me. It was more the proficiency and the capability of teaching.
Yes.
How did you learn that skill of teaching somebody else to fly?
Well, I as part of my flight training at the school that I attended, I actually graduated with a flight instructor certificate and an instrument flight instructor certificate. So all the training was done at that school.
Right. Okay.
Yes. At least the practical aspect of it. Then everything else I learned with each student.
Yeah, there's a great deal of wisdom to be learned through experiences like mm-hmm. that. How long did you instruct for then?
I instructed for about a year and a half at that school, and I focused mainly on instrument training and commercial training. And as I mentioned, back then it was extremely competitive, and at that time aviation wasn't doing great. People weren't getting hired.
Yeah.
So at the particular school where I was instructing, we started losing our students because of the economic issue. And as a result, I was the first one to lose my job since I was the last one to get hired.
Yeah. And so what did you leave that school with? Was it hours? What qualifications and hours did you have at that sort of time?
By the time I left that school, I had approximately 850 hours of flight experience. And I graduated with an associate's degree plus a commercial license, a certified instructor, and certified instrument instructor.
Wow, okay. And that didn't give you the opportunity to go into the airlines, or was the economy too tight?
The economy was extremely tight at that time. The airlines weren't really hiring, and it just seemed like it was a struggle at that time for the airlines and for aviation as a whole. So since I had started in aviation at a fairly young age, I hadn't had the chance to pursue other things that I was interested in. So I took 3 years away from aviation to do that.
Wow. Okay. And then what brought you back then 3 years later?
Okay, well, in those 3 years, I lived a lot and I grew up a lot. I believe I matured a lot. So okay. By then, I was probably barely 23 years old when I left aviation. And I don't think I was quite prepared for it. Since I started so young, I believe that my life was always going to be in aviation. I had been flying every day. So at first, it was quite an adjustment. I think there was even a period of depression just because you're used to flying every day for so many years, and then you get a life change in which you're not flying anymore.
Yeah.
So I spent 3 years, as I mentioned before, I spent 3 years away from aviation, in which I pursued other things that I was interested in. And that for that last year, I was actually extremely sick. And when I recovered my health after that last year, I decided to go back to my first love, which was aviation. And the way it happened, actually, it's a story that always warms my heart, because it happened a year prior. A year prior to that, I was doing an engineering presentation with one of my friends, and her dad came to our presentation. And after he learned that I was a pilot, he didn't want to talk about anything else other than flying, because he was a pilot himself.
Right.
So I remember so vividly then he told me that the day that I was ready to go back to my career, and the day that I was ready to go back to flying, that my career would be there for me and that he would be there for me as well.
Wow.
So I always remember that, because as I mentioned, I think that probably happened a year and a half prior, and right after that I had an extremely good opportunity. I was doing engineering at that point, so I had an internship with NASA. Things were going great for me, but after that I got really sick. So I spent a whole year trying to recover my health, but
yeah.
When I finally healed, he was actually the one that brought me back into aviation. One day I was having dinner with his daughter, and he called her and inquired about me, invited us to go over his house, and he invited me to join his flight team at the Civil Air Patrol. He was the commander of the squadron at the Civil Air Patrol, and that's how I got back into aviation.
Wow. Okay. Now, something just slipped through then, and I don't know whether I caught it or not, but did you say you were an intern for NASA?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, I was an engineering intern for NASA.
Tell us about that. That must have been fascinating.
Yes, it was. So when I left aviation, one of the things that I did was I did a lot of volunteering things, and I also went back to school for mechanical engineering. And as part of that, I spent about a year doing research, which granted me the opportunity to do a robotics engineering internship at NASA for about 3 months. So I got to work on robotics, on robots, day in and day out. It was an amazing experience.
Wow. Okay. And they say NASA is one of the best organizations to work for in the US. Is that true?
It really is. It's a magical place. I mean, this was in Pasadena, California, and
yeah.
In fact, it's so funny, because I was having an amazing time. At that time, we had a DARPA robotics competition going,
yeah.
Competition with all the major engineering companies that were competing to make the best robot, and we had a show going on, and I remember the airplanes flying over and the robots on the ground, so I kept diverting my attention between the robots and the airplanes. It was so cool.
Wow, okay, what a fascinating time. So
yes.
you came back into aviation through the Civil Air Patrol. We don't
yes.
have that in this part of the world. How does this work? What were you involved in?
Okay, so the Civil Air Patrol is it's an auxiliary for the Air Force. We are in charge of search and rescue, but we're also primarily in charge of promoting aviation to the youth. So my previous job in the Civil Air Patrol was to promote aviation to our youth.
Okay, and you're still in the Civil Air Patrol now,
yes.
aren't you?
Yes.
What rank do you hold?
I hold a captain rank.
Okay, maybe I should have introduced you as Captain Romero at the beginning of the interview. Sorry about that.
No worries. Actually, you know, many of the members of the Civil Air Patrol are people that are retired from the military. Yeah. I think I'm the youngest one there with a captain rank, and that all happened because I'm a flight instructor.
Yeah. Are you flying for the Civil Air Patrol now?
Yes.
And what aircraft do they fly?
We fly Cessna 172s and Cessna 182s, and we actually also have a glider program now.
Wow, okay, wonderful. So what then happened after that? Because I know where you're at now.
Yes.
What's the story that took you into the airlines?
Okay, so as I mentioned before joining the Civil Air Patrol, I had spent a whole year recovering from my health, and it had been quite rough. I wasn't able to walk, so it was a huge transition for me to be able to walk again, and then to be able to get in an airplane again. At that point, I said, you know, I don't know if I can even take off or land anymore, and even so much more to be a flight instructor. So this gentleman, the commander for the Civil Air Patrol, his name is Bill Vickers. He pushed me so hard. He was like, kiddo, you have to go back to flying, and you have to go back to your career. So the intention wasn't just for me to go back to flying, but for me to take my old role as a flight instructor. And that at that point, Peter, that seemed like such a tremendous task for me.
I can imagine. Gosh, if you're not mobile, I've had a few injuries, nothing too serious, but I know what it's like to just walk on crutches. And it's just such a challenging way to be. I'm amazed that you then went on to fly.
Yes, well, you know, it's at the Civil Air Patrol, I encountered such a tremendous amount of support and mentoring. And Bill Vickers, our commander, actually set me up with a gentleman that took me under his wing. I actually call him my aviation grandpa now. And he, you know, we went and we flew quite a bit. And that's how I regained my flying skills, and more importantly, I regained my confidence to be able to go and flight instruct again. So that all happened in about 4 or 5 months, and then I finally had the courage to go and apply for a flight instructor position and make a living out of flying again.
Right, okay. So you went back to instructing again?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. And then how did that lead to the next stage in your career then?
Okay. Well, the following two years after that, I went back to flight instructing, and I went back to flight instructing for another 141 school. But this time it was an international 141 school. So we had contracts from Panama. We had students from Korea, Taiwan, Thailand. So a huge variety of cultures that were there specifically for flight training. So that's what I went back to. But also, I also started doing a lot of freelancing. And when I mentioned before, at the Civil Air Patrol, I found such a huge amount of mentoring. And one of my mentors there introduced me to several leaders in the aviation community. And I started getting a lot of private clients to instruct. So I did both at the same time, instructor for the 141 school, and also had my private clients. And the combination of that plus the Civil Air Patrol really helped me to gain a lot of confidence in myself and in my abilities. So I did nothing but fly and rebuild my aviation career for the following 2 years until I finally had the courage to apply for the airlines. And again, it was the guys from the Civil Air Patrol that just kept pushing me, like, okay, it's time to move on. You know, it's time to move on. You got to apply for the airlines.
Yeah. So you did?
And yes, I did.
How did you get on? Was it as daunting as the 10 people in the room for your first flight instructor's course?
I actually went to three interviews for my airline job.
Yeah.
The first task was just application. The applications are such a huge task, and I had to do a lot of paperwork for the application. So that was the first portion. But I've always, Peter, I've always been extremely blessed in the aviation community and all my friends that they have just helped me tremendously and encouraged me, even if it's just bugging me every day with, are you done with the application, you know? So I actually had three interviews. The third one was the one that I, the third company was the one that I got hired on. I made a couple of what people would consider mistakes on my first two, which I quite don't regret now because I love the airline that I work for. So I think it was meant to be.
Yeah. fate had its arm around you.
Yes.
So you were accepted by an airline. What was the training like? I know you've been in the sim, you've been doing some other training. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That part of the process?
Yes. So the training for the airlines was a 3-month training that started with what they call an ATP course, where it's a requirement, at least here in the U.S. now, for you to go through that. It's about a week long, where you have a little bit of sim prep, classroom work, and the goal is for you to take the ATP written exam at the end of that course. So that was the first portion, and that was followed by 3 months of training for my airline. The first month and a half was a classroom from 8 to 5 every day, in which we learned company procedures, in which we learned systems, the aircraft systems. And after that, it's a couple of weeks in a ground trainer, in a static trainer, in which we learn what we call flows.
Yeah.
Flows for the particular airplane. And then after that, we upgrade to the sim training.
Right, okay. What is the aircraft that you're...
It's an Embraer 145. It's a 50-passenger.
Wow, nice.
Yes, I love it. I love my jet.
Yeah, I bet you do. I bet you do. So what was it like then... The first time you actually got to sit in the 145 and fly it, what was that like?
In the actual airplane?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, it was amazing. It was amazing. I actually learned a lot in the sim. The sim training is quite intense.
Yeah.
And the check ride is quite intense as well. So it's extremely... It's almost like the airplane. So when I got to the airplane, everything felt just as the sim did, except maybe for the turbulence, and I felt the landing a little more. But everything else was just like the sim. The first time I actually flew the airplane, it was with 50 passengers a night. So it was
Wow. It
was amazing.
Yeah, wow, tough. That is tough.
Yeah.
And what sort of routes are you flying at the moment?
Right now, I'm based out of Denver, Colorado, and we go to all the nearby states. We also go into Canada, so
yeah.
We fly central, south, and also west of the country. So, for example, my flight one day ago was to El Paso and back.
Okay. What's the airline life? The passion for flying is one thing, but it can be quite a demanding life, particularly for women who still don't make a large proportion of the pilot community.
Mm-hmm. I would have to say that I love the airline life, but I would have to say that first of all, it is something that you truly have to desire. You truly, truly have to desire it. There are so many challenges that you have to overcome during training that if your heart is not set on it, then there's just no way that you're going to be able to put up with all the stress and the rigorous training. So it's something that you have to truly desire. And from that point, everything else, as far as the things that you have to deal with, you know, just come as part of the job. I would have to say that the freedom and the sense of power and liberty that you get from the job outweighs everything else that you have to do.
That just sounds really, really inspiring, Brenda, and certainly the journey you've been on. I think I've learned a bit about perseverance as well.
Yes, you have to persevere. You know, one of the things that people complain in the airline industry is having to commute for work. For example, in my case, my base is in Denver, Colorado, and I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so I'm a commuter myself. I actually have to get on a flight to be able to go to work. But even then, I found amazing opportunities. I got to jump seat and actually fly in the actual cockpit of a Boeing 737. So I'm getting treated like a princess even on my way to work. So, you know, what's so harsh about that?
Yeah, that's true. And Brenda, then just before we go, what words of wisdom could you give, even though you're still quite a youngster, I might add, to maybe some youngsters wanting to take that journey, particularly girls?
Okay, well, I would have to say that first you have to decide that you want it. You can't half want it. You have to truly want it, because the journey ahead is adventurous. It's fun, but it's also going to require a lot of work and perseverance and tenacity on your end. And I'm going to add a little story if we have the time. I'm going to add a little story from my airline sim training, just to give people a reference of the things that you're going to have to deal with. So on my airline training, on my sim training, the first time I actually got in the sim, it was practically, it wasn't a session yet. We were just, my partner and I were a little ahead of the game, and they decided to throw us in the sim for that lesson. That lesson required what we call V1 cuts, which is considered one of the hardest maneuvers in jet training. It's basically you losing an engine as you're rotating for a takeoff.
Yeah.
So the very first time I jumped in the sim, I had been flying Cessnas and Grummins, you know, general tiny aircraft. We cruise at about 100 knots or so. And they throw me into a jet that I had never touched, never flown in before. Everything is happening so fast. There's so many things to look at for one of the hardest maneuvers. So I died 4 times in that session. 4 times.
Yeah.
Yes, I died 4 times in that session, and each time I died, I learned something new. So I remember so perfectly that night I spoke to my mother and I told her, you know, Mom, it was a great day. I got to fly the sim for the first time, and I died 4 times. And she was like, Brenda, for the love of God, how is that a good day? You died 4 times. And I said, you know, Mom, it was basically a preview of what's to come for me. And that for me is winning, because I got a preview of what I need to prepare, and I'm going to research and figure out what I have to do, what do I not have to do in order to be able to perform this well. And that's exactly what I did. Every time I died, I learned something new. Like, okay, I can't do this. Like, okay, I need to put more rudder. Okay, I cannot let the rudder go. And, you know, my partner on the drive back to the hotel that day, he was a little puzzled as far as like, why was I not discouraged after dying 4 times? He only died 2. And I told him, Bill, I am an extremely practical woman. I've been a student, I've been an instructor, and I take my training from a very practical point of view. You go in there, you do something wrong, you figure out what you did wrong, and you fix it. You correct right away. So I never went home puzzled about what I had done wrong. Each time I died, I knew what I had done wrong, and I didn't do it the next time. So in turn, when it came time for that maneuver in my actual training, I never struggled with it. and I never got discouraged either.
Wow, that's quite an inspiration. Well, I will call you Captain. Captain Brenda Romero, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Joining us and sharing your story. A real inspiration.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And one more thing that I would like to add to the people that are interested in pursuing aviation and flying is the fact that knowing how to fly an airplane brings you a lot of freedom. I feel complete and utter freedom in my life. So I wish the same for the people that are interested in learning how to fly.
Well, thank you so much. And a big thank you to Victor Jones as well for contacting us and suggesting that we have a chat to you. It's really, really been a pleasure and, as I said, a real inspiration.
Thank you. Thank you. He's a great friend of mine. Thank you so much.
G'day. I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Amanda, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you very much, Peter. Good to be back.
It's great to have you on the show. It's been far too long. Now, the last time for any of those avid listeners to the program we talked was 5 years ago when we flew in the Tiger Moth at Compton Abbas. But a heck of a lot has happened in those 5 years for you, hasn't it?
Huge amounts from, yes, it's been quite a journey for me. I mean, I've then now got my Tiger Moth myself, managed to buy my own Tiger Moth. My father has unfortunately passed away, and I've of course have had breast cancer. So it's been, it's been very turbulent for the last few years, which is why I then stuck the stake in and said, you know what, life is for living, and I have to make an attempt at the Australia.
Well, let's come to that in a minute. Just for those who don't remember your background, tell us a little bit about how you got into flying and certainly how I ended up coming across you in a Tiger Moth.
Yes, I left school at 15 with no exams to speak of. That's just what happened in the schools I was. I'm dyslexic as well, which I'm now promoting as a dyslexic pilot. And I then studied hard and long to get my qualifications. But to actually be a pilot, I had to get a job and get a car and all that kind of thing.
But
and it was my dad.
Amanda, where did that come from, though? Where's the passion for aviation?
From my dad.
Right.
From
okay.
my dad. So he built remote control models. The last model that he built was the Waterbird, which was the first float plane to fly in this country in 1911. And he was actually building that at the same time that I was buying the Tiger Moth, and neither of us knew that we were doing this. So it was all quite spooky. But yes, he built remote control models. He built me a Paddington Bear flying on a marmalade sandwich when I was a kid. And I used to, it was amazing. And you used to be allowed to drop sweets at that point over the crowd. So out of the marmalade jar, these sweets would come when he used to go to the air shows. And yes, so I was spending the weekends going around picking up crashed bits of remote control models, because, of course, the attrition rate in remote control models is slightly higher than the real thing. I was very glad to find out that when I started in the real thing. And that's where it came from. And I didn't actually realise. I had wonderful parents in the fact that they encouraged me to do anything that I wanted to do, to be happy sort of thing. Mm. And I didn't realise quite how strange it was to be a woman pilot until I grew up and became a commercial woman pilot. And then It's a real shame that we're not encouraging more women into aviation, the whole of aviation. You don't have to be a pilot, you know, everything.
Well, Amanda, let me just ask you about that, because that's an interesting point. Brenda, our previous guest, made almost an identical point. She went into aviation. She didn't for one moment consider that she would be any different from anyone else. And like you, it wasn't until she was in the sector that she realised, hang on a sec, you know, I'm different and people are treating me differently.
Yes. I've ended up saying, and not that I'm trying to advertise, there are other pieces of yeast thing, but it's a bit like Marmite. Hmm. The more you do in aviation as a woman, the more people either love you or villainise you. It seems to be that. Now, I'm in a very good position where I'm surrounded by a huge amount of people that are very supportive of me, male and female, and therefore I would encourage women to join, because there are huge amounts of men that are very supportive to you be joining, to us joining and being part of the aviation community. Mm-hmm. So it's and there's difficulties in all factors of life. So, yes, but it's a shame that I am unusual, and it's a shame that it's still such a... No, it is, but it's a shame that it's still such a... I think it was something like still 5% are commercial women pilots, which is... Why is that so low? And one of the reasons that I ask, I'm beginning to talk in schools now, and one of the things that isn't sort of shown in schools is that women can be pilots. So... still the role models in school are that women are the flight attendants and that the male and the men are pilots. Hmm. So we have to start sort of from there and change that, really the role model side of it. Yeah. To prove, I mean, and this is it. I'm nobody. There's no magic to me. I keep saying this. I am perspiration, 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. If I can do it, anybody can do it. Believe you me, you know, dyslexia and no silver spoon in my cupboard, I can tell you. So this is hard work.
How challenging was having I can't even say it.
Dyslexia.
and learn to fly. I don't have that. And yeah. I found doing my private license terribly, terribly challenging.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, actually,
I'm not very clever. That's why. But
I couldn't possibly say. Somebody said to me the other day, as a bit of a joke, they said, "Oh, how dangerous would it be to fly with a dyslexic?" And I was horrified. Hmm. And I said, "Actually, in some ways you're better off with a dyslexic." Now people are going to start getting upset at this, but a dyslexic's mind works in pictures and works in spatial awareness. Hmm. So rather than working in sequencing and words, my brain works better in the charts and knowing where the other aeroplanes are in the sky. So that gives me a huge advantage when it comes to the actual flying side of things. Hmm. And knowing about the aeroplane and learning about the about what the aeroplane is doing as well. You know, it's sort of that feel for the aeroplane.
Yeah.
Which I think dyslexics have an advantage of. So... yes, you still have to pass all the exams, and I failed my fair share of exams and had to resit them, which is very irritating on the wallet. but if I can do it, then it is just perspiration. It really is. If you're determined to do it, and then go out and do it, as I say, there is no magic to me.
So when I last saw you, you were a flight instructor. I was lucky enough to have an hour of your time. You went on then to join a display team from memory?
Well, not quite. That didn't come to fruition for lots of different reasons.
Right.
it just one of those things. It hasn't come to fruition, and therefore I've sort of let that go, and
yeah,
that's fine.
Okay.
And maybe we need to have a woman formation team. If the women are out there, let me know and we can start our own one.
Yeah.
But yes, so that didn't happen. And a lot of things in aviation, you know, you draw the line on the map and you hardly ever fly that line. So a lot of things in aviation don't happen. But what did happen was I needed to get an aeroplane to be able to be part of that formation team. And when I got my aeroplane, I then thought, actually, I want to do the Australia thing more than I want to do the formation side of things. So it then became the, I want to honour Amy Johnson and do UK to Australia trip more, and therefore I'm going to put more of my effort and more of my finances into that and go for that.
Now, Amanda, where did that come from? I remember you talking to me about this as a bit of a pie in the sky idea.
Yes.
But where
yes.
did that nugget come from to want to follow Amy Johnson's steps?
And this is the thing. This is hopefully the inspirational thing for people out there. When we first met, it was 5 years ago. Is that correct?
Yep.
And 5 years ago. And now I've just done my first attempt at solo to Darwin and had to call it at Beirut because of world politics, not because of anything else. And therefore, 5 years has changed. And yet I've had so much bad stuff in that. It also has proved that you can actually do it if you take it and talk about it and make it that you want to your dreams to happen. So the thing was, I loved Tiger Moss, I love vintage aeroplanes, and I love all of that 1930s exploration of the world. If I was brainy enough to be able to speak Russian, I'd be an astronaut, you know. I'd love to do stuff like that. But and I read all these incredible people, you know, Sir Alex Henshaw, Lady Mary Bruce, you know, all these things. And they were Lady and Sir and everybody with a silver spoon. And then comes along Amy Johnson, who hasn't got a silver spoon. And she has to have a secondhand aeroplane, and she has to beg her dad for the money to buy the aeroplane, and she has to get sponsorship, and she has to work for a living. She's an engineer, and she has to, as I say, I do talks to then fund the next lot of flying. And I read her book and I suddenly thought, wow, if she can do it, I can do it. And I hopefully now people can look at me and go, well, if Amanda can do it, I can do it. And that was where it, and seriously, that was where it came out of. I read this book and thought, I have to do it. This is it. I, you know, secondhand aeroplane, off we go. And I tried the first attempt in 2015, and the aeroplane unfortunately needed to have quite a lot of work for it because there was a bad engineer who had not made a good job of it. There was an actual MOR about that. So people need to be educated on, you know, good engineers and bad engineers.
Yeah.
She's now with the best engineers possible. She's at ARC at Duxford, and they are just absolutely brilliant, and Vintech. And this is it. So I then suddenly started to write a plan, and I actually went on a business course of all things. And they said, well, you need to write a plan for all of this. And it's when I started, and this is going to sound really weird as a dyslexic, but it was when I started putting it down on paper and actually writing it in my books. And I've got loads of books now, loads of notebooks, and actually planning it and going, right, what this month do I need to do? What do I do need to do by next month to be able to get it going? Who do I need to contact? What safety stuff do I need to have for this trip? You know, when do I need to book my vaccinations? When do I need to do all of this? And when you start scheduling stuff and actually writing it in your diary and going, I'm going to do this, and I'm not going to sit and watch telly all night, I'm going to actually do this, then that's when it starts to become real. And that's when it then starts to gather moss. And suddenly you're in the middle of it, and you know, my diary was just packed of what I needed to do to set off on the 11th of May.
Yeah. But you also did most of this whilst, sadly, not being too well.
Yes. So basically what happened is my as well as me not being well, my dad started to be, looking back at it now, he must have started to be unwell when we first met five years ago.
Yeah.
But he was such an intelligent man. He covered it up. He didn't know he was covering it up, but the specialist said he was covering it up. And we still don't actually know what he died of. He died of some kind of brain disease, which they put in the umbrella of Alzheimer's. But it certainly wasn't normal Alzheimer's. And throughout that, I watched this wonderful man disintegrate in front of my eyes. And obviously the stress of that wasn't helping in everything. And in our family, we've had breast cancer, and I knew that breast cancer was going to be part of my life at some point in time. I wasn't ready for it to be right now. I was hoping it would be in another 20 years' time.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, you know. So I came back from fighting to put my dad into a home because he couldn't walk anymore. And the week that I came back was when I found a lump. And this is another thing that I, as well as trying to get women into aviation, I am absolutely horrified that women don't check themselves, because it's such a simple thing to do every single month. You just have a quick 5-minute check to make sure that there's nothing going on. And because my mum had had breast cancer, I'd learnt to check myself and checked myself all the time. I found a lump. I found several lumps and they've been absolutely nothing. And then I found this lump and I thought, I just haven't got time for this. I have not got time for breast cancer while my dad is dying. But it turned into breast cancer. It just kept getting worse. I had bad news Wednesday, and then I would cry all day Thursday. And it ended up culminating in a double mastectomy with reconstruction. Fortunately, I had the best surgeon on the planet. He's one of the leading reconstruction breast cancer surgeons. The oncologist was great. They are so proud of me, what I have done, because I said, you have to get me fit to go and do this.
Yeah.
So you don't often get a surgeon turning around and saying, I'm proud of you. But he did actually say that to me.
Wow.
One of the things, I'm really proud of what you've done. And he was amazing on how he helped me. I had, you know, my other half, Mike, is just brilliant. He was the most bestest person to help me through it. You know, he's coping with me with breast cancer, with my dad dying. I don't know how he did it. He was amazing. And my poor mum, you know, my mum, we also lost her mother as well. So she's coping with that dad, and she was facing losing her daughter at the same time. And this is the point. I managed to made it to my dad's funeral after the surgery. And it was at that point when people were coming up to me and saying, your dad helped me in so many ways, because he was a great mover and shaker in STEM, the science, technology, engineering and maths, or math, as he used to say with the Americans. And so many people came up to me in the wake and said, your dad helped me with my exams. Your dad helped me with my career. Your dad helped me with this. And I knew nothing of these people. I absolutely knew nothing. And my dad had this fantastic legacy and all these people that he had helped. And at that point in time, I thought, you know what? I have to do what I was put on this planet to do. And that is fly around the world, which I know sounds absolutely bonkers. But I just thought at that point, I have no idea how much time I have left. I have no idea when the cancer is going to come back, all that kind of stuff. But I know now, I thought, do you know what? Because my dreams were always someday, or one day, and someday and one day never happens. And this is what I said about scheduling it and going, right, this is what I'm going to do this week. This is what I'm going to do next week. And I broke it down into that. I broke it down into exactly what I was going to do week by week. So therefore, it didn't seem like a big thing. It's just, right, I'm going to, you know, contact the, get my life raft next week, get my vaccinations, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The flight itself is also designed to promote women in aviation, but to encourage other women on your journey as well, isn't it?
Yes. One of the people that I met in Beirut is the Ministry of State for Economic Empowerment of Women and Youth. And I have that written down because it's quite long.
Yeah.
And they were amazing because they are setting up women out there in different kind of jobs, and not just aviation. They are encouraging women to do all kinds of things. And I met masses amounts of people along the journey, who women pilots, women engineers. You know, Huda in Beirut is just the most bounciest person on the planet, and she does pleasure trip. She does basically the Compton flying in a 172 around Beirut, which is absolutely brilliant.
Wow. I did see the pictures. I saw some of the pictures on social media and the receptions that you had there. They seemed so welcoming.
Oh, it was, I mean, in some areas I was a villain and in some areas I was a hero, and you just think, okay, well, the places that didn't want me, they didn't want me. But so Mannheim was one of these amazing places where there was a woman pilot and engineer who was showing me how she was rebuilding her vintage aeroplanes. In Sibiu, there was one of the daughters who was just got a PPL, and there was a dyslexic girl who drew me this lovely picture of me in my Tiger Moth, which was so... which inspired me to be able to stand up and say, do you know what, I have dyslexia, because it inspired, you know, as a young girl, she can then go, I can do it, you know, dyslexia is a gift rather than anything else. And so Sibiu was an amazing place. Cyprus was another amazing place. And then, of course, as I say, Beirut, where I was feeling sorry for myself because I was having to call a halt to it.
Yeah.
But you can't feel sorry for yourself in Beirut. You just can't, because these people are just amazing. They know how to live. They've got a war in their memory, so therefore they don't want war again. And that was a very empowering place to be. And as I say, there's all these things that I was invited to go and see what the women were doing out there, because they have even more layers of difficulty with all kinds of, you know, religion and political and economic difficulties out there. So, yes, and, you know, if I've helped people along the way, that's just amazing. So,
well,
yeah.
Tell us about some other steps along the way of the flight, Amanda. Where did you depart from?
I departed from Biggin Hill. They gave me a fantastic reception. And when I came into Biggin, so I departed on the 11th of May. And on the 10th of May, I flew into Biggin Hill, and I actually flew over Croydon Tower, which is still an air tower. They still have an air tower there. And I flew over that to sort of do my little nod to Amy on the way, because I couldn't do it on the way out because I hadn't got enough fuel to do it. So I did it on the way in to do it on things. Yeah. And Biggin Hill was the nearest place I could depart from where Amy did Croydon. And they were just amazing. Signature down at Biggin Hill did me this fantastic sort of departure party, and everybody was invited. And I didn't invite you. So I'll have to invite you to the next one. Yeah. And they came and filmed it, and it was really good. And it was quite emotional because my mum was there, and of course my dad wasn't there. So that was quite an emotional thing to say to my mum, and she said, you are going to be safe. And I was kind of like, of course I am, you know, this is, safety is my absolute number one priority, whatever I do. So,
and I remember that when we flew, you made great demands of me to ensure that what I was doing was safe.
Yes.
And you were talking earlier, Amanda, and I look back now, I didn't for one second think of you as being a woman or a man or whatever. I was just happy to fly.
Yes.
And is there something in aviation that makes this a bit different for us all? Is there an opportunity through aviation to encourage particularly more girls into STEM subjects and engineering and aviation? I know I'm passionate about it. It just feels a different sector. Do we have an opportunity to do more?
We do, and I'm going to try and do that. As I say, I'm going to be talking in schools towards the end of this year and next year with another great pilot who's flown an autogyro, and who is doing all kinds of amazing things with autogyros. So we're hopefully going to be starting to spread that word, and he's also involved in STEM. So we're hopefully going to be, you know, mapping out that, absolutely. And my dad, who went around and did lots and lots of talks and encouraged girls and boys into all the STEM, different, like you say, engineering, because this is the point. People think of pilots as the top, but there isn't. There's, you know, without engineers, pilots would never get off the ground. Nowadays, we need air traffic control. We need people sitting in offices writing the manuals. You know, we have to have... that there's so many different roles you can do operations. You know, women are brilliant at operations because they can sort of multitask and they can talk to people, you know, calmly and all that kind of thing. So, yes, and it's hopefully I'm going to start, as I say, encouraging. I'm also bringing out a dyslexic sort of awareness side of things, and I'll definitely let you know about all of that so that I can help more dyslexics, because when Irina came up with the picture, it really hit me in the fact that now maybe I have, I wouldn't say an obligation, I have, it's an honour. I have an honour in the fact that I'm now at this point in my life where I can actually turn around and help people, and I can actually turn around and say, you can, you know, you're going to be a success as a dyslexic. Yeah. And again, with the STEM, you know, women, if they want to be in aviation, you're going to be a success in aviation. You know, don't let anybody tell you no. Don't let anybody, stop you. Yes, it's not going to be a straight line. I'm not going to say it's not. And I'm not going to say it's not going to be difficult. Of course, it's going to be difficult. Of course, you're going to need hard work and you're going to need persistence on that. But if you have a little bit of persistence, then you can just do amazing things. So, and as I say, hopefully I can start to encourage and be part of that.
And Amanda, there's unfinished business. You mentioned the solo to Darwin trip got curtailed in Beirut because of political issues in that part of the world. You couldn't transit a certain airspace. Where does that leave things on that journey? Are you going to try it again? How's that going to work?
Yes. Yes and yes. So I had, through my other half, he knew people who security advisors, and they were absolutely brilliant. They were the ones who said go to Beirut because Beirut's an amazing place.
Yeah.
And they were the ones that said, stand by in Beirut, let's see what's happening with Iran and all the waters down there. And Pakistan and India were both very welcoming, and I'm sure I could have got across the border at some point, but basically the Iran and the Iranian waters around there were not safe enough for me, and I was advised not to transit any of that. And of course, that's where I got all my fuel position. That's where I got everything sorted.
Yeah.
So, and you can't just, it's very difficult when in a vintage aeroplane to just go, oh, go a different route. And if you don't have all the money in the world, and I don't have all the money in the world. So therefore I couldn't, I had to make some very tough decisions at that point of whether I come back. And they said that's the waters are just going to escalate. They're not going to calm down at the moment. So I then made the decision to come back. Yes, I am going to complete it. It will probably be it'd be definitely next year. It's not at the moment because I'm taking time out now to do some more things to the engine. And it'll definitely be next year. But the documentary guys that came on board, Tony Klinger with Give Get Go, which is another amazing company, because his company, Give Get Go, gives people the chance to get going that wouldn't have normally the chance to do that. So we're talking about STEM and everything. You know, the documentary guys are part of this sort of encouraging side of things. And they were so pleased, actually, that AI'd stopped for safety side of things. And also because the editing guy was going, I don't know how I'm going to fit everything, because I'd had so many things happen and so many wonderful moments and so many dramas. They said, I don't know how I'm going to fit everything into a... So the first cut of that comes out next week.
Okay.
That's going to be a standalone documentary by itself.
Yeah.
And they are so pleased with all of the filming that's happened and everything, because they taught me, we were chatting about this with things, they taught me a little bit how to do selfies and film stuff. And I hopefully have got more than just my feet all the time. but they were so pleased with that. We're now in discussions to do other adventure flying as well.
Oh,
so watch this space, because actually I think it's going to be an amazing couple of years. It may take me a couple of years to do the solo to Darwin, depending on what happens with the political side of things. But also, one of the biggest problems was oil, not avgas. I managed to position the avgas, but oil was one of the real problems. And I think that's one of the things that affected my engine. So I'm going to have to, and you can't send oil because it's a dangerous goods and all these kind of boring things. So I'm going to have to rethink all of that and try and get oil in various places. So yes, so actually, by sort of sticking my stake in the ground and going, I'm going to do this, and also the dyslexic side of things, you know, I'm talking to amazing people and through STEM and that. So I think there's going to be quite a few opportunities that are going to be very exciting in the next couple of years that are completely different to where I would have said my life was going. But yeah, I'm loving it at the moment.
Well, not to steal any thunder from the documentary, but just give us one of those little dramas that you had on the trip.
Well, the very first day I took off, I didn't think I was going to get over the channel because the British weather, of course, you know, of course, on the 11th of May, Amy took off on the 4th of May. I took off on the 11th. It was thunder and lightning and, you know, black clouds all over the place. So I took off in between the rain. And as I'm heading out toward the channel over the Kent coast, I'm getting lower and lower and lower. And I'm down to 900 feet. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to turn back on my first flipping leg. The camera's just going to be there. Oh, no. There was just this little gap and I could see it. And I thought, I know the weather's supposed to improve when I get the other side. So I'm going to push on. So I pushed on. And as I came, and this is the wonderful thing of flying. And I think this is where everybody loves flying. This is where it doesn't matter how much money you've got or who you are or black, white, you know, male, female with pink spots on. When I coasted out over the channel with blue skies in my own Tiger Moth that I had saved all these years, the engine was humming beautifully. My goggles are now drying because the sun has come out. And I'm there pinching myself going, I'm really doing this. I'm really doing this. And that was just an amazing feeling. And then, of course, I had another few hours over France and then had to flip and divert because the weather turned in again. when I got to, you know, I didn't get to Mannheim on the first day. I had to divert to Saarbrücken. And again, air traffic control were brilliant at that point because said, you know, that they helped me out and they said, look, you've got an airfield on your right-hand side. We switched the lights on for you. You know, you can go in there and everything. And they were a little bit confused. They were kind of like, oh, what are you? So that was also quite, you know, I didn't even make it to my first destination. Right, and I was a little bit sad when I landed. I think all the emotion of the fact that I'd actually started it, I was actually doing it, I was actually there. And because I wasn't meeting anybody, nobody knew I was there, I just was driven to the local hotel and I sat there in my room eating my own thing and couldn't get onto the Wi-Fi, couldn't Skype anybody and was feeling a bit miserable. But it was just the sheer emotion of the fact that I'd actually started this and I was actually doing this. And, you know, so it went on like that. The highs and the lows just kept coming like that. So,
You talked about dyslexia. And I bought a copy when we first met. You do have a book. Is there any plans to do any more writing?
Yes. Confessions of a Lady Pilot.
Yeah.
The confession series, because it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, is Confessions of a Lady Pilot. And the Confessions of a Window Cleaner and Confessions of a Postman and all that things was actually the documentary guy's, Tony Klinger's. It was his father's series.
Really?
So we had a little discussion about copyright.
Wow. Oh dear.
No, it was all very funny. It was all joking. So he thought that was really funny. And again, you think, wow, that the universe is sort of trying to say something.
Yeah.
So Tony, again, the documentary guy, Tony, has written quite a lot of books. So he's now helping me write the book for this adventure. And this time I'll hopefully put in more dyslexia side of things for this one as well. So I don't know when that's going to be done yet, because I've got a few articles to write first and I've written I've sort of done the basic outline for the book. And then Tony's going to help me on that. So, but yes.
Wow,
so,
you're busy.
Book two. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. I did enjoy that. I did enjoy the first one. So looking forward to that. But Amanda, for those who want to follow you, get in touch or potentially support you on the journey, how can we find out about you?
AmandaJHarrison.com is the website, and that has all the information and it also has all the buttons to Amanda Harrison Pilot, which is Instagram, and that has a donate button. On the website has the donate button, and that has the book and everything there, and that will have all the stuff. And the tracker is still on there, so you can still go in and look, because Kinetic 6 loaned me a brilliant tracker that pinged every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So you can still go and look at the amazing flight.
I was tracking you. I just wanted to say, Amanda, when you don't have any major sponsors for this, do you?
No, my major sponsor has been me.
Yeah, there is no major sponsor, and there is no major support team flying with you in a C-130. Nope. or anything like that. This is literally you and Gaxan, which is your Tiger Moth.
Yes, it is pure solo, because in the front seat is a big tank. So the big tank is like a person, and we take the seat out and put this big tank in so that I've got 7.5 hours, which is still not as much as Amy had. Amy had 9.5 hours because she had a gypsy moth.
Yeah.
The reason I bought a tiger moth was because I couldn't afford the gypsy moth, but I bought the second best thing, which is a tiger moth. So I'm still trying to do it in the aim. So am I. So I'm honouring Amy by buying a similar aeroplane to hers. Mine was secondhand. I'm completely solo. There is no support plane following me, and all of the operations were done by me and my other half. Mike Wigg actually does operations for a living.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll do your operations. And when I phoned up people to ask about clearances, when we started chatting, the one guy said, you're better off doing it yourself, Amanda, because you know what you're doing, because I'm a commercial pilot. So I filed all my flight plans. We did the clearances between us. We did all of the permissions between us. So there was two people doing all the logistics, which was a nightmare, I have to admit, because I'd get into the hotel and then I'd be having to figure out, you know, my flight plans and the weather and all that kind of stuff. I booked all the hotels, everything. So it was all done by...
It was interesting to watch you from a distance, though, because... I've seen other events like this of people doing unusual journeys, and the way they talk is quite not, I don't know if superficial is the right term, but when you talked as if you were talking from your flight plan. So the detail you used in a lot of your messages was actually really good. We could actually follow you, and I know I'm a bit of an av geek anyway, but we can actually follow you in detail. Does that make sense?
No, a lot of people have said that I'm very... I am.
It was very thorough. Yeah.
Yeah. What you see is what you get.
Yeah.
There is no second layers to me.
Yeah.
I'm very out there, very truthful. And I'd like people to know. And in the book, you know, I'll be writing sort of the bits that I did, so that therefore you can follow that in detail as well. And I think it's interesting for non-aviation people as well. I think a lot of, I've got quite a few followers who are non-aviation, who said it's just interesting because I'm incorporating, you know, the amazing receptions that I got at places like Sibiu, you know, in Romania, which I wasn't going to go to. And they sort of asked me to go there because they got this gastronomical event on, which was amazing. So, And just meeting all those different people. And when you travel solo, I've done this before, when you travel solo, something is different than traveling with other people. Because when you land in a tiger moth, everybody loves the tiger moth and they all think it's amazing. But then they're kind of, well, where's your support aeroplane? And where's your, you know, where's your team? And I go, no, hang on a minute, I'll just put my microphone on and I'll just get me GoPro and stick me little selfie on, you know, and we'll film this. And I think that's... And as I say, this is why I'm saying I'm an ordinary person that's done an extraordinary thing. And I hope people take that away. Hopefully there is no superficial stuff about me. Hopefully, as I say, this is it. I'm completely genuine. And I've been bowled over by the amount of help and love and real affection that has been sent to me over the last few months. And real affection when I had to call it a day in Beirut. And, you know, one person had said, oh, you failed. And somebody else turned around and said to him, well, if that's the way Amanda fails, you know, I want to fail like her, sort of thing. You know? That's a good quote. I'll have that quote. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for your time. I know it's very precious. You're very busy, but we're going to all keep track of you. I don't think did we pick up your Twitter and Instagram?
So the website, Amanda J amandaharrison.com. I had to put the J in it because Amanda Harrison is an actress in Australia. Yeah. So it's amandajharrison.com. The Twitter is @solotodarwin. The Instagram is Amanda Harrison Pilot. My Facebook is Amanda Harrison Pilot. And LinkedIn is Amanda-Harrison. But if you put Pilot in, you'll find me easier on the LinkedIn side of things.
Amanda, thank you so much. And I know it's 5 years down the line, but I won't ever forget that flight that we had in the Tiger Moth. It was just amazing. You're such an inspiration to all of us. Thanks so much.
Oh, Peter, it's been absolutely great. And keep encouraging women especially into the aviation. You're doing a great job with that, so keep on with it. That's brilliant.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to Extended. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and the team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. If you feel able, please leave us some feedback on iTunes or your podcast playing app. You can find Extended on all popular podcast players now and, of course, on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. This programme is, of course, produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and on our Extended Facebook page. You'll also find me on the Aviation Flight and Video Podcast Group on Facebook. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.